for visiting the doctor and easy access to other services you may need. Learn more at harrisonhealth.org.
It's the final week of the nominating period for the Fresh Air Board of Directors. Nominations close Wednesday, October 30th. Visit kfai.org/board for more information on how to run for the board.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Hennepin County Public Health. It will be back to school before you know it, making this a great time to help your child get up to date on all their immunizations, including the MMR vaccine. The MMR vaccine is safe and effective and is the best way to protect your child from measles. Hennepin County Public Health is hosting free vaccine clinics for children ages 0 to 18. No registration necessary. Our next vaccine clinic is Saturday, October 26th at Hosmer Library. Learn more by visiting hennepin.us/immunizations.
KFAI is proud to present Bane at Ice House on Saturday, November 23rd.
Minnesota's own singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Bane has teamed up with the Foreign Exchange Music Collective for his third full-length album, Lifetime. Bane's new work dives into the realms of folk, soul, psychedelic, and synth pop, blending introspective with sonic exploration.
Joining Bane at Ice House is Dutch producer and Foreign Exchange member, Nicolay, who will also provide a special DJ set after the show.
Tickets for Bane can be found at the Ice House website. Visit icehouse.mpls.com for more details.
Hello, Counterstories listeners. We have been doing this show in various formats for 10 years this year. In all those years, it has always been the four of us, myself, Halili, Luis Maria Frias, Anthony Galloway, and Don Eubanks. However, we are sad to report that Don has passed away. He was our friend, he was a mentor, and a teacher, and he was our family member. In the weeks to come, as we take time to grieve, mend, and reflect on Don's life and his immense impact throughout the state, we will be re-airing some of Don's favorite episodes and topics. Welcome to Kona Stories, a show by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers, and Kona Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate of Dendrils Group.
I'm Luz Maria Frias, Deputy Attorney General with the State of Minnesota. Any comments or opinions I express are strictly my own and should not be attributed to my employer.
Anthony Galloway, our other co-host, could not join us today, unfortunately. But we're going to move on with our conversation today, which is another grab bag, mostly focused around stuff that SCOTUS has been up to, the Supreme Court. I don't even know where to get started or how many we can get covered in the time that we have. But I guess the first thing that happened that probably in timeline-wise was the ICWA ruling.
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of timeline, I guess if we were to try to put that a little bit in context, because it's been a few weeks since we've recorded. Mm-hmm. And so, but the ICWA, or the Indian Child Welfare Act, decision came out, I think, almost 2.5-3 weeks ago. And what was, to me, surprising, and while it left me a little perplexed, but perplexed in a good way, because I think in Indian country, many of us were dreading that the Supreme Court was going to rule in favor of the plaintiffs who brought this case forward, arguing that the Indian Child Welfare Act, which had been put together by the tribes as a way to keep Indian children who had been forcibly removed on many different levels from Indian families via through boarding schools and or via through foster homes or adoption agencies. And I mean forcibly, I mean some children were removed from hospitals and then their mothers lied to about those kids. But anyways, the Indian Child Welfare Act had been put in place to give tribes the ability to have some say if an Indian child was to be removed from their family, and all, and as a way to keep that child connected to their ancestors, their identity.
For people who are still trying to understand, essentially the law says that an Indigenous child should be placed with same or similar, same family, you know, within the blood relatives or similar, like Dan was saying, within the same tribal community, so that the child can then continue their cultural upbringing and honor those traditions that are so valuable to Native country. So
the plaintiffs brought this case forward, arguing that the Indian Child Welfare Act was unconstitutional because it was based on race. And so there was a white family that was trying to adopt a Native child. ICWA kind of prevented that adoption from moving forward because the child was enrolled in a tribe, and that tribe exercised its rights to try to place that child with a relative or someone connected to that tribe or American Indian community. So this case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially ruled that the Indian Child Welfare Act was not based on race, but essentially based on tribal sovereignty. So where many of us were expecting this very conservative Supreme Court to rule in favor of the plaintiffs, it was quite surprising to us when they in fact upheld tribal sovereignty and argued and essentially said that the Indian Child Welfare Act was not based on race, which fits in with the political identity, the political standing that Indigenous people have in this country, is that because of the nation-to-nation relationship that we have with the federal government and that covered treaty making and rights and all that are inherent with that, that it did give us a political standing that differs. You know, it doesn't make us better, right? Doesn't make us any better, but it just differs. And there have been a few times on Counter Stories where I've kind of mentioned that as a people, we don't consider ourselves a minority because of that political status, because of that tribal sovereignty. And in this case, the Supreme Court had helped upheld that.
You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Lee Lee with co-host Luz Maria Frias and Don Eubanks. This show is supported by AMPRS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.
The ICWA case, it was a major victory in Indian country. I mean, all my friends who identify as Indigenous were just posting very heartfelt messages, right, on LinkedIn in particular, where I tend to be and gravitate to, as not only as a relief, but more so, as you said, Don, very aptly, a surprise and a shock. But I also want to hold up, though, that in Minnesota courts, in particularly juvenile court, there has been a strong effort statewide that also is part of a national movement that judges be trained in ICWA and that there should be what are called lead ICWA judges across the state for every judicial district. And in my family, my husband is the chief lead designated ICWA judge for his district and the district that he presides. And so I wanted to just call that out to say there are some efforts in the judiciary to really address the decades-long, well, centuries-long injustices to Native families. And I remember when I started in this space over 30 years ago, when I was at the House of Representatives drafting legislation here in St. Paul, this was a big issue, the placement of ICWA children, Indigenous children, and to follow the ICWA law or not. And pervasively, counties throughout the state were not following it. And for things to now finally start taking shape, three decades later, I mean, that's also too late, right? But it's being done. Of all the damage that has been done to community by this particular Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court justices, that is at least one light that gives me some sense of hope for Native families and Indian country in particular.
Well, I'm happy that we're moving along in that a positive direction. A part of me says, we need, you know, there's so much more that needs to be done. So again, you know, that particular ruling perplexed me, surprised me, but then the recent rulings, brought me back down to Mother Earth. And I think that, you know, the next big one is their recent decision on affirmative action on college admissions from Harvard and North Carolina, where the Supreme Court just ruled that race cannot be used as a factor in admitting students to Harvard and North Carolina. And I think that has huge repercussions.
Yeah, you know, this hit me really hard, the decision, and I can unpack that in a little bit as to the why. But I want to share some statistics that I hope really help contextualize for folks how unfair this is. When you think about Harvard, 43% of white admissions to Harvard are either legacy, donors, children of or kids of faculty or athletes. 43%, that's almost half, right? And then when you look at the Ivy League schools, of which Harvard is only one, so you think about Yale and Princeton and Stanford and things of that sort, a recent lawsuit that was just filed actually on Monday of this week by the Lawyers for Civil Rights said that 70% of Ivy League schools' donor-related and legacy applicants are white, which means that donor-related applicants are nearly seven times more likely to be admitted than non-donor-related applicants, and legacies are nearly six times more likely to be admitted. When we think about this, it clearly, you know, the United States has been framed and based foundationally on a number of things, but one of the principles is that meritocracy is what rules, meaning if you pull yourself up by the bootstraps and you do the hard work, that you then earn the land of promise is yours, right? The land of the American dream is yours. But this case, as well as all the statistics, only two that I've reached, you know, that I've shared here, and there's many, many more more statistics that come to mind that I have access to. Meritocracy is a myth. This is not about you earning anything. It's about you having opportunities, legacy admissions in particular, and kids of faculty and donors. That's really where it's at. One of my sister's son was admitted to Harvard. He went there as an undergrad. He had three roommates in Harvard. All three were legacy and or donor kids. It came to a point where at any point in time where my nephew is walking through campus as an undergraduate student at Harvard with his roommates, that the roommates would try to one-up each other in terms of how much money any of their grandfathers or uncles had given and donated to the schools. One of the buildings was named after one of the kids' relatives, right? And they would then poke fun at each other along the lines of, well, your uncle only gave X million, while my grandfather gave X number of millions of dollars. And so they're one-upping each other, and it was like a game for them. They still wanted to one-up him, right? And show him that, yeah, you don't have that money. You're here, but you're not as important as we are. They were still so intent on othering him and making him feel less than. So when this decision comes through last week, it hit me in various ways. Of course, it hit me collectively, right? And thinking about all of the students in the future that will not have access. It also hit me really hard to think that some of these justices, U.S. Supreme Court justices, frame their comments along the lines of, there's no more racism, so therefore we don't have to think about race anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think about all of the pain and bloodshed that's been shed by our Black community historically and to this date, in the erasure of Black people as a whole, as well as, of course, Indigenous people and brown people, but mostly Blacks. I mean, let's be honest, right? And then it hit me for my own family and my children. And it's still hard for me to talk about it. So I encourage folks to ask themselves, what are you doing for self-care in terms of your mental health as you are dealing with this pain and this trauma? I know in the workplace, a good idea is to have listening sessions. We are doing that in my workplace. One of the local bar association groups is also hosting listening sessions for attorneys who identify as BIPOC. There is a real understanding that this is visceral for our Black and brown communities, Indigenous communities. And the fight has just been so exhausting today to think that this monumental landmark decision is one more heavy piece to have to carry is so triggering for the trauma that Black folks, Indigenous folks, and people of color are carrying on a daily basis. So I'll stop there.
You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Hui Lee with co-host Luz Maria Frias and Don Eubanks. This show is supported by AMPRS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com. We know that affirmative action is important based on everything you just said, right? But also, universities in California had done away with affirmative action, and they testified in front of the Supreme Court that once they did that, Black and brown applicants, enrollees, dropped by 40%. They're doing specific mm-hmm. outreach and everything to try to get more applicants and more Black and Latino students to enroll but at UCLA and UC Berkeley, but they're not being successful. And they're saying, you know, we need affirmative action now. Like, we understand they're kind of like the guinea pig of what happens is that students are applying to less competitive campuses than they're not entering into STEM fields is what the studies have been saying. So, and yet the Supreme Court still upheld what Well, not upheld, I guess, but the Supreme Court decided to do away with it in their ruling. And as far as like your personal story, there's also part of me that feels like, especially with Harvard and the Ivy League, it seems like we all know that you get in because your legacy, and that at least half or more of the students are there based on how much money they have or who their parents or grandparents are. And it's just kind of like accepted, right? Like, though, saying that to someone isn't necessarily new. We all kind of know that, and it's just the way it is. And now it's just going to get worse.
See, because what you're delving into now is class and class differences. Mm-hmm. So, but this ruling, I mean, you know, that's essentially what Luz just described, mm-hmm. what she was talking about, the difference that her relative was experiencing by folks who are born in that 1%. And if you look at the history of the Ivy League and those schools, they're fulfilling the purpose of why they were created. And if you look at the graduates, I mean, you know, who runs this country? Are graduates from Harvard, mm-hmm. Columbia? I mean, and so what you're doing.
But we see that some of them are not very smart.
Hey, no one said anything you had to be intelligent to have money. I think the backside of this decision is the fact that this case was brought forward by Asian students who were arguing that that affirmative action in race needed to be eliminated because they weren't getting their spots into these universities, which, again, I think creates a backstory tension. This decision set us back. I mean, I can't, you know, it just set us back from 40, 50 years of fighting civil, I mean, just fighting civil rights, just trying to gain an equal standing footing in this country. And I'm not even throwing in equity. I'm just talking about equality, because the Supreme Court based their decision on that phrase in the Constitution that says all men are created equal. And because of that, race-based affirmative action was unconstitutional. I mean, that essentially was their argument. So do we take that literally? How do we interpret that?
Yeah.
Because if we look at that, when this was set up, it meant, when it said all men were created equal, we know through history it meant white landowners, right? Men, women weren't even included in that. So this ruling just scares the bejesus out of me, because are other things going to come forward now? You know, the largest benefactors of affirmative action in this country were white women. Not us.
They're currently still.
Exactly.
Have been, I mean, for 50 years, and currently remain the biggest beneficiaries. Yeah, for me, Don, I appreciate you raising that point. So the plaintiffs, the Asian plaintiffs, were represented by a group called Students for Fair Admissions, right? And to be clear, according to recent data, 2020 Asian American voter survey that was conducted, 70% of Asian Americans support affirmative action. It's described as programs designed to help people, Black people in particular, women and other BIPOCs, get better access to higher education. And that finding was echoed again in a 2022 survey. So 2 years later, 69%, so relatively the same. But in a 2023 Pew survey, 53% of Asian Americans who had heard of affirmative action also believed it was a good thing, though 76% said they did not think colleges should consider race or ethnicity as a factor in admissions decisions. So that's where the conflict comes, right? It's when is it applied? And it's that fine tuning of divisiveness when it comes to, here's a sliver of a piece of the pie, the American dream. And if we have to fight for that same sliver, then it becomes, it's either you or me. It's cutthroat, yeah. Right? It's very individualistic, right? Versus culturally speaking, the Asian culture, much like the Latino culture, we're collectivist. And so that doesn't hold true across the board. And also to be also clear, there have been scores and scores of Asian organizations that have weighed in on that SCOTUS decision since last Thursday that speaks to them being in opposition to that ruling. So like any other group, Asians are not a monolith either, right?
Right. I mean, people are very split, yes.
Same tactic that was used in the ICWA. All right. And so the person who kind of, you know, was in the forefront of that was the one Native American lawyer that was part of this other kind of conservative white attempt to overturn the Indian Child Welfare Act. And no different than what you just described and what brought forward. Because, you know, with Asian students and Asian community is not monolithic. There are so many different ethnicities that make that up that you know, you can't make any one generalization about any particular group. And I think it also feeds in with the model minority stereotype that mm-hmm. Asians deal with and have to carry, right? This feeds right into it. But it's sad that we have reached this point where members from our own community are used as the tip of the spear to help try to overturn these advances.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all of that is at play, all of it. The modern minority myth, you know, you're a person of color, but you're not a person of color because you're the model, you're ideal, you know, person of color. So, you know, there's that, there's the whole, you know, there's the, like you said, there's an array of us. There's those of us who are very new, like the Hmong, the Karen, right? There are communities who have been here for many, many generations, like the Chinese and the Japanese, you know, and in reading a lot of the coverage on this, the responses, the most happy responses have been from, quote, prominent businessmen, prominent. It's just the same as in the white community. It's the rich guys. It's the rich guys who are so happy about this decision. You know, it's the same thing that we just talked about.
You know, the irony of all this, you know, this is why history is so important. And I am the first to admit I'm a history geek. When you, Hilly, you mentioned the Japanese and Chinese being here longer and benefiting more from being the quote unquote model minority, is you forget, they forget, some members of the Chinese community forget that in 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed by Congress. And what it did, it was the first law ever to be passed in the United States to significantly restrict immigration. It provided a 10-year ban on Chinese laborers immigrating to the U.S. I mean, there's more to that, right? And then, of course, the Japanese internment camps, right? I mean, how fast people forget that, look, you have not always been viewed as a model minority. History has shown that when it's convenient for folks to lift you in a way to use you to divide and conquer, they will do so.
These rulings, man, you never know how they're going to go. These days, more than ever, I feel like. And we'll keep talking about it here on Counter Stories. I'm Hui Li, owner of the Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers, and Counter Stories producer.